Los Angeles who will talk to us about technopolitics of hope. And this is the fourth talk now in our series Dialektik der Technik, Dialectics of Technology, which is organized by the Fix Initiative in Berlin and in Frankfurt as a joint series. And it is dealing with the ambivalence of technology as being immersed in power structures, but also at the same time holding the potential for liberation and for the improvement of living conditions and communication and so on. Before we heard talks from Michael Koltan, who was talking about artificial intelligence, Simon Schaub, who was talking about technology in the so-called platform economies, and Timo Krüger, who was kind of looking at ecological aspects and dimensions of technological development. And these three talks have been taking place offline because it was summer and we thought the whole Corona situation is a bit easier to handle. With Peter, we are glad that we can just, you know, cross this distance to California via Zoom and be able to talk to him. Before I introduce Peter further, maybe a few practical things. We'll have Peter's talk for about 45 minutes, I guess, roundabout, and just go into the discussion directly afterwards. And for you all to know, the talk is going to be recorded, but only the audio of the speaker. So you can definitely leave your camera on. No images will be recorded, and we will put the audio file of the talk on our website afterwards. Also, please don't ask questions in the chat, as I probably won't be able to keep track of them. It's always easier if you just wait until the discussion and raise your, or maybe not raise your hand, but rather put a star or your name or whatever into the chat then, and then I can ask you to ask your questions while we are in the discussion. Otherwise, it's going to be a bit complicated. Also, one more thing, if you would like to be informed about our further talks and our series, you can write a private message to Beanie, and she'll put you into our newsletter, and you'll just get emails informing you about Jurfix. Jurfix talks. There's not going to be any other kind of announcements via this channel. Okay, I think I haven't forgotten anything, so I can actually start introducing Peter, who is just leaving. So, but maybe he's back again. Peter Redfield is professor of anthropology at the University of South California in Los Angeles. So for him, basically, it's early morning at the moment. It's 8:45, where we are already at the end, or maybe not at the end, but later in a quite beautiful day in Germany, I think. Not too hot anymore. And Peter has been trained as a cultural anthropologist. He's always had an affinity to history, and he's been working on science and technology in colonial and post-colonial contexts. And this is also what he's going to talk about today. And he's going to tell us more about a particular technology in South Africa and the hopes and utopias, maybe also the problems, of course, which are associated with this technology. So I'll just hand over to Peter, and I'm very much looking forward to your talk.
Oh, thank you, Kirsten. And thank you both for the kind introduction and for this invitation to this group. My apologies at the outset, because I will be speaking in English. My German is enough to get me to a train station and order small meals and things like that, but I don't think that it would be pleasant for any of us to try and attempt to communicate that way. So I thank you for your linguistic aptitude and willingness to engage in English. And if there's any time where you can't hear me or there's something that is not clear, please let me know. I will be speaking from slides. I'll be trying to share my screen now and showing you some images, because I think that's a bit easier for people to follow, especially in a virtual setting. And it's also easier for me that way at this point in my life to remember what it is that I'm trying to say. Some of the things I'll be talking about, I've also written about. So if there are things you would like to know more about, I'm more than happy to share that information with you. So let's see. There we go. The topic which I'd like to talk to you about today is, as suggested, is humanitarian design and the technopolitics of hope. And the aspect of hope, aspiration, imagination about the future, desire, all of this, I have to admit someone from the waiting room. We're juggling this, actually, this whole presentation in a way is going to also be mirroring some of the things that I will be talking about. What I want to introduce to you is the field of humanitarian design, and I'll be talking as an anthropologist about a specific case and trying to think through the logic of a case to speak more generally about problems that I see as being quite widespread. I've spent much of my career writing about technology in relation to development, humanitarianism, efforts to do good, both the European Space Project, which created the Ariane rocket and then came to play a major role in satellite launches in the 1990s, all of which was based in French Guiana, a strange part of South America, which is still a part of France. And then I did a project about the organization Médecins Sans Frontières, looking at questions of how biomedicine, what anthropologists call modern contemporary scientific medicine, how that travels globally and the different kinds of ambitions and issues that emerge when you have an effort to provide care, medical care, and seek to foster life and ameliorate suffering on a global scale. And that is part of what the background trajectory that led me to this particular project, this area, and what I'm trying to present to you today. The themes I'll be talking about are utopianism, realism, and the question of incremental change, where that fits between what is in many ways a binary. You've been following the theme of dialectics. I understand as a thinker I'm not quite as focused on the dialectic and that I'm less certain about the precision, which that term can sometimes suggest, of the relationship between opposites, but clearly utopianism and realism as traditions for thinking about the realm of possibilities before us are intense relationship. And incremental change is often describes a place between those two extremes. And it's one which is often perceived as being disappointing from the perspective of those who hope for more radical transformation of a given social order. And so the question, abstract question I want to present is that of what would be the lower threshold of utopian ambition? How modest could a utopia be? At which point it would cease to be a utopian, but simply become a repetition, a realist repetition of the same, of the thing that is already there. And so you would have no aspiration, you would have no possibility of dreams, you would have very little room for the hope of a better tomorrow. And related to that, the question of what can people do while they're waiting for a better future? Even if you're working and anticipating perhaps a progressive future in which things would be better, what do you do in the meantime? What do you do while that future has not yet materialized? Those are the questions which I want to consider. And what I'll be doing in this talk is to try and invite you to problem space. I try to think through problems and problematization as a theoretical approach. What are the things that create disturbances within a system, which then reveal something about the stakes which are embedded within it? And what I've been thinking about and trying to follow and understand for the last decade or so is the domain of humanitarian design. That's clever little gadgets that people are coming up with to improve the world in some small, modest way. I'll say a bit more about this in a second and give you some examples. But what I'm trying to focus on is the technopolitics of modest improvement. And technopolitics is a phrase that's used by some people in science and technology studies to emphasize, in particular, the degree to which all of technology is, in some sense or other, completely imbricated and infused with political questions. It comes from somewhere, it's constantly engaged with the political field, and it has political effects, unintended ones as well as intended ones. And the fusing of that term of technopolitics is meant to imply that you cannot have techniques without politics, and you can't have politics without techniques. And I, in particular, with this talk, with a lot of the work that I'm trying to do, I'm wanting to emphasize the second part of that, that political positions and political aspirations, say for equality, for justice, for a better tomorrow, they also have technical implications, technological implications, that if you seek to provide everyone with a better life, you have to have the material means to do so, or figure out a manner in which you can satisfy that aspiration. And humanitarian design, as I see it, is a very revealing domain, not because I think it is successful. Most of the stories I'll tell you are very mixed at best, and many of them represent classic failures of development ambition from the perspective of anthropology. But they're a wonderful site for thinking about larger problems, I suggest, and for exploring the intersection between realist impulses and utopian impulses. That is, a desire to make something better, but also a recognition that there are limits of what is possible under given circumstances at any moment in time. And my approach is one where I want to underscore critical uncertainty rather than suggesting that I have a certain critical position which I am sure of with which to advance, because I think we live at a moment where many things are uncertain or they're unsure, that the answers of yesterday do not always hold perfectly for the problems we currently face. And also to recognize that the gesture of critique itself, of taking a critical position, is also implicated once you've cast the problem large enough, that we all are positioned somewhere and we all have a stake in the material conditions of life. And since much of what I will be talking about is a realm of small fixes, modest improvements, band-aids, essentially using the American term for a sticking plaster for a small bandage, prepackaged bandage that doesn't really cure, that provides a cosmetic fix, is often used as a pejorative expression. I want to be suggesting that we need to think about these small fixes more carefully than simply using them as a focal point for denunciation. In part because I want to take very seriously the question of the meantime before aspirational futures, or what do people do while they're waiting, and to recognize the relative brokenness of modernist systems and modernist norms. That is, the field of technology which has produced the world that for many of us who are fortunate enough to live in a place where things are generally working, Electricity is on, trains are running on time, although I understand they're not always running on time at the moment in Germany. If we live in a world where you expect things simply to work, that ignores the wider field of potential breakdown and the need for constant repair and energy for that state to be realized. Okay, good, it is working now. So pausing for a second, let me just give you the objects of study, which I'm trying to look at, humanitarian design, since that phrase may not be familiar to you. It's my summation and gloss of a set of associated movements in different fields. You find a lot of this in architecture, you find it in schools of engineering, you find a lot of it currently in worlds of development professionals and humanitarianism. You find lots of it in global health, where people are trying to come up with some small way to make life a little bit better. So you respond to a problem of people not having shelter, of homelessness, by trying to develop some kind of simple mobile shelter or some kind of tiny home which can house people who are living on the streets, say, of a big city. Or you come up with a better way to filter water, or a better way to provide some minimal care in one fashion or another, often through a gadget, through a product, and much of it is also thinking through the logic of markets as opposed to the logic of nonprofit engagement. And I was quite surprised by how large this world had become and how much moral energy has gone into it. So as an anthropologist, I've been trying to think about why and what might it tell us about the world around us. And I think part of what it tells us is precisely this, about this area of the meantime, of what do you do with problems that are immediate. Because in my understanding of what we currently call humanitarianism in the world, and what the aid world calls humanitarianism, is problems which are pressing. They're very presentist problems. It's not thinking about the long term. It's thinking about people who are suffering right now, someone who does not have enough to eat right now, someone who has no place to sleep right now, somebody who's actively infectious with an infectious disease, say, someone who's struggling for breath, someone who in some way or other needs help at this moment, needs assistance. And the question frequently is a question of survival. And so from this perspective, this field of small objects is devices, that of devices for slightly better survival. So it's a very minimal kind of aspiration. It's a minimal better tomorrow that is being considered. And a lot of the devices are focused on settings of humanitarian crisis, of emergency, of moments which are ruptures in the everyday life world that people have been experiencing, or settings of endemic poverty. A lot of what I'll be describing today is precisely that, informal settlements around large cities in the global south. And just to give you three examples very quickly, you have ready-to-use therapeutic food, in this case produced by a trademark formula by a Nutricept, a private French company called, this is branded as Plumpy Nut, which is a very controversial intervention medically, but has also been quite successful in the field of malnutrition treatment, of treating starvation, not at the level of root causes. It does nothing for why people are starving, why especially children under 5 who are most exposed to the threat of death in moments where you have extreme food stress. It does nothing to address the political or economic factors, but it does produce, it's basically a glorified form of peanut butter, a nutritionally designed food which will prepackaged, sanitized, which will increase survival rates among children who are nutritionally stressed. And it's been in many ways quite effective in that sense. There are many children who've survived because of this who would not have survived otherwise. Or the Life Straw, which is produced by a once Danish, now Swiss private company, which has had many iterations and is now one of many filtration devices being sold around the world, but was originally designed also as a kind of a purifying mechanism so that you don't have to have a municipal water system to have clean water, but you can drink polluted water safely. Or many, many efforts to redesign sanitation systems, the simplest being this, the pee poo bag, a better plastic bag, in this case a biodegradable sack, for people who are in circumstances where they are using plastic bags as toilets. And so these are the kinds of objects. They're all controversial. They're all very interesting. I can tell you much more about them, but I'm already a bit behind in my presentation, so I won't. I just want to give you an idea of the kind of things that I'm looking at and interested in. One last one, which then does lead to the example I'll be focusing on for this talk, the Embrace Incubator, which is designed for infants who are born prematurely in settings where you don't have electricity. So you cannot use a conventional incubator of the sort that would be used in a hospital in Germany or elsewhere where you have a large stable infrastructure and you have an excellent medical system. And infants who would have historically died 100 years ago, 200 years ago, certainly, now can live because of technological intervention. So you have an expansion of the possibility of life earlier and earlier into the moment of birth for infants who are born prematurely. And so if you look at the Embrace Incubator, this is what I see is going on in the meantime, is it being an effort to extend modernist norms, that is the German hospital, beyond settings where you have modernist infrastructure, where you beyond the setting of Germany, to places, very remote places, where you have no stable power supply, and you don't even necessarily have a clinic which can provide clinical support. So this is the world of the meantime. And to give you just a theoretical, very quickly, a theoretical framework, we can come back to this later if it's of interest or use for you, here, part of what I'm referencing in the background is Reinhard Koselleck's influential argument about modernist time. And he uses some phrases that, for me, I find helpful because I find evocative phrases helpful to think with, that he's talking about the relationship between the space of experience, that is, the world that we are encountering at this given moment, and the horizon of expectation, that is, what we anticipate for the future. And that part of the shift towards modernism as an attitude, as a way of living life, is the expectation that the future will be different from the past, from the present. And it contains within it a very deep seed of progressive sensibility, an expectation that the future will be not just different, but it will be better than what has gone before. So with all of this in place, then let me introduce to you my example, which I want to focus on for today, which is the iShack, an initiative that began in South Africa, and I'll tell you a bit more about it. It has a very particular history, but for me, I first encountered it through the name and doing some work in South Africa and reading about it and then going and seeing it in that context, I was quite struck by the notion of the name, which I think does some work for us without even knowing anything about the specificity of the example. You can just think about the sequence of the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, the i, this and that, all the branding of Apple computers, which has been transformatory, which has created all kinds of a horizon of expectation of technological possibility. What would it mean for there to be an iShack? And what kind of future does it signify, a world where some people get an iPhone and some people get an iShack, using the English term for a place where someone lives that is seen as the housing of poverty, housing of something which has been cobbled together, put together informally, and it's not something which would ever be designed. And the I in this case stands for the improved shack, and the idea behind the I shack was incremental upgrades for slums, that is for shack dwelling areas, informal settlements around cities in South Africa. What to do to make the kinds of places that people are living a little bit better in the meantime? What can people do while they're waiting for better housing? And so what I want to focus on today is the I shack and the concept of the incremental upgrade. In South Africa, from this perspective, for purposes of this discussion, is a part of the world which is, I think, is particularly telling. But South Africa is an infrastructural frontier. It's a place where you do have a lot of infrastructure. It's a relatively wealthy country in some ways, comparatively, when you're looking across examples of post-colonial societies, but it's also one with striking inequality and differential outcomes from history. It's a place where you had not just a colonial history of dispossession and domination, but you also had a regime which notoriously was based on racial segregation and ideologies of racial supremacy, one which then clearly created a landscape which was segregated and also differentiated in terms of class and in terms of material possibility for the inhabitants. Now, since 1994, the regime changed and the political landscape has changed. And in 1994, a new constitution was put in place, which guaranteed citizens of the country a whole host of material benefits. However, those material benefits have not all been realized quite painfully. And the promise of the post-apartheid society has not, in that sense, been fulfilled. And here I'm just showing you a couple of cartoons from South Africa, which are comments, commentary on this, that basic services, infrastructural services, have become the focus of a great deal of political contestation in the context of South Africa. And part of this is a question of housing. And what does it mean to be promised to have a constitutional guarantee that everyone has a right to access to adequate housing, but not actually have a house? And of course, again, the landscape is one of a seizure of land, forced removals, and segregation, so that you get images, if you look at it from the air, images like this, where you can quite starkly, as you can in many parts of the world, know who is living in relative affluence and who is living in relative poverty. And under apartheid, all of this was by design. This was not by accident. It was not a side effect of capitalism, but it was directly the product of governance. Since 1994, there's been an effort through the Reconstruction Development Program, the RDP program, to build houses, among many other things, not all of which have been well built. And although many, many have been constructed, demand completely outstrips supply. And so there are many people who are left waiting for a long, long time in order to have houses. You also have the population is growing and the population is moving. You have many people who are migrating from the countryside to cities in the classic modernist story of population shifts. And so you have the growth of informal settlements around cities, not just formal townships, which are recognized, but also areas where people are simply, they've put up shacks and they are living. And service delivery, as mentioned, has become a political flashpoint. And if you want to read more about this, there's a good book by Antina von Schnitzler precisely on this topic in South Africa. Now, where the I shack came into being is on the outskirts of the town of Stellenbosch, which is in the Western Cape. It's a bit to the east of Cape Town. It's smack in a very well-to-do part of South Africa. It's the wine country. There's lots of wonderful wine which is being produced in this area. It's also a relatively wealthy college town. Stellenbosch University was very much a white university in the center of apartheid ideological thinking during the apartheid regime. And Stellenbosch carries the baggage of all of that as a town. But like every other major settlement in South Africa, it has informal settlements around it. And Enkanini is one of these, which came into being in 2006. It was empty land, and then you had people who moved onto the land, squatting, essentially set up shacks. There was an effort to remove them that ultimately failed, and so it became established, but not fully recognized, and that's what's meant by an informal settlement. So it's not a fully legal place. It's at the edge of legal recognition. It receives few municipal services. Over time, they get more, and over time, many informal settlements become more recognized, but it is a struggle throughout. The residents who live there are mostly recent arrivals to the city. They are not people who've been living there long-term. That many of them are experiencing economic insecurity and income fluctuation, and they have few strong ties to the other people around them or to place. And this I want to stress to make it clear that this is not a village. This is not a traditional setting for the people who live there. And many life worlds around the world that people are engaged in a post-colonial context are not villages. They're not places where you could simply roll back colonial history and go back to something else. This is a fully modernist world. It's a fully modernist experience in that sense, and a fully colonized experience historically that has led to this present that we now experience. So Enkanini is a marginal community on the outskirts. It's no one's first choice, a place they would want to be living. And to quote a line from another researcher who looked at this, as someone told him, it's not a particularly nice life for many of the people who are living there. Just to be clear, that is the world. There is real need, and there is dissatisfaction with the present and with the status quo. So enter into Enkanini, the Sustainability Institute, which is a group that was started loosely in affiliation with Stellenbosch University to provide a space for people to explore an approach to creating a more equitable society. They were focused on thinking about ecology and sustainable development, as well as social justice and improving the world in terms of the very stark differences of possibility that South Africa represents. And in many ways, there's a whole lineage they're a part of in terms of thinking. They're quite influenced by Shack Slum Dwellers International, an international NGO, and the South African affiliate of that. And starting in 2011, they developed the iShack as part of a number of efforts to improve waste, sanitation, and energy in Enkanini, in this informal settlement where people were living, had problems in all of these areas. And so they built a prototype of what they called the iShack, the improved shack. And I want to note a few things about this prototype. It did have social, ecological, and health ambitions built into it. It was an effort to co-produce this with the community, or at least some community members were involved in the initial design. There was an effort to use reclaimed materials to be efficient with them and to have an ecological sensibility in terms of its placement and how it was built. The power which was provided was to be provided by a renewable energy source, solar panels on the roof. It wasn't a lot of power, but it would be enough to give you light and run a TV and charge a phone, and to reduce the health hazards and fire hazards of people burning kerosene and paraffin lamps and using candles, which was otherwise what people would be doing if you're off the grid and you don't have light in the evening, none of which is very healthy in a poorly ventilated shack, one that's full of flammable materials. The ice shack attracted a lot of attention from the media and government and foundations, including eventually the Gates Foundation, which provided the Sustainability Institute some funds to continue it. And I think the best way to conceive of the ice shack is as a realist container for utopian ambitions. In a sense, it was not promising to do anything extraordinary, but it was promising to do some things that would be seen as being good from the perspective of people who did have ideals in the domain of ecology, social justice, and health. The prototype, however, as in many of these stories, never quite materialized at scale. A few were built, but it didn't roll out in the way which was initially imagined. Instead, it encountered a complex political field of competing interests. Some of the people who had been involved in the community organization, as the designers had imagined it, became embroiled in disputes with their neighbors. The community was not unified. It was suspicious of this effort, and some people wanted more. They didn't want solar. They wanted electricity. They wanted grid electricity. They wanted full electricity where you didn't have to worry about a battery, where it was just constantly on. And they wanted what wealthier people around them had. So we could describe this as being a classic development failure at this stage. However, the ice shack did not simply go away. Instead, it became a system of rooftop solar projects. So rather than the full prototype of building a whole new kind of improved shack, it simply became a system of rooftop solar installations. And the ice shack project decided that it would take more of what they called a depoliticized market approach, one which would try to reach potential users as consumers rather than reaching them as community members to appeal to their desire to consume a product. This did have some modest impact. Hundreds of people signed on, but it also encountered problems, technical problems, and also financial problems, in that many people would sign an agreement but then not pay. And so the market solution was not simply working in this context. We could see it again as a second failure. However, the ice shack altered its approach again. It made some technical improvements, and it found a new source of funding from government electricity subsidies, which normally an informal settlement like Ankenini would not have been eligible for, but through negotiation, the ice shack managed to get funding that way. And so what it then proceeded to do was to offer clients a basic service for free instead of charging them. So that took payment issues off the table and expanded, slowly but surely expanded its reach. There continued to be some political tensions. There continued to be people who preferred an illegal hookup to the South African grid. However, that grid was increasingly under stress. And so when parts of Ankenini became eligible for electrification later on, there were some people who wanted to keep the ice shack as a backup system because it had become clearly of some use and some value. And at the same time, the ice shack model had expanded to other informal settlements beyond Ankenini. So this is the example which I want to present to you. There are many more details I'm skipping over and happy to say more about. But for our purposes today with this presentation, the thing which I want to put on the table is, should we call this a success? Should we call this a failure? Or should we ask other questions? And I want to go back to the questions which I started with of how small can a utopia be? Is an improved shack a better world? Is it sufficiently enough of a better world that it can be called something that would be utopian? Or would it simply be seen as a kind of realist resignation to the inequality of the present. At the same time, if one wants to have greater ambitions for transforming housing in South Africa or transforming things more broadly in the world, what do people do while they're waiting? What do people do while they're waiting for what would truly be a better system or what would be a real solution at another level to the problems, the material problems that people are facing in terms of what they're living with? And what might people be waiting for? Because as I mentioned, the South African power grid is one which has increasingly displayed problems. It's had a lot of load shedding. And these are a couple of cartoons to illustrate that problem, that while they have had some expansion, demand has shot up well past their capacity. There have been some scandals of where money did not go, questions of whether there were proper investments. There's a lot of fossil fuel that goes into keeping the South African power grid going. So what kind of better future would it represent if one moved beyond the ISHAC to full electrification for everyone, say, in Kanini? And of course, one can expand this to the rest of the world in thinking about the power grid elsewhere. And so I'm just showing you an image of a composite image with clouds carefully removed and things like that from satellites of what the electrified world looks like, to recognize that there is power. We expect power to be on. Some places it's on a lot. You can see the bright points. There's a lot of darkness. There are places where people do not have electricity. And what does it mean to live with technologies? And many of the technologies we take for granted when the question of power and where we get it is at stake, newly at stake. And so I see the ISHAC as being part of why I'm interested in it, as with all the other examples of humanitarian design, as being a kind of interscalar vehicle. I'm citing the work of Gabriel Hecht, a historian of technology here, of being something one can use, an example one can use to move between scales, across scales, of going up or down. And so moving from a very specific location in South Africa up to asking questions about global problems. I'm sorry because I'm messing myself up. This is a good example of technological questions, and perhaps it will work also to illustrate this point of broken world thinking, because I have two keyboards here. If I hit the wrong one, then it jumps me out of the PowerPoint presentation, and so to go back into it. But here we are. What I want to gesture to at this point is what the theorist of information technology, Stephen Jackson, calls broken world thinking. He does a lot of work on IT. He's thinking about the construction of informational technology and the worlds of computing, that recognizing that breakdown may not represent the exception, but rather breakdown may be a constant possibility for any functioning system, that maintenance is actually central to the functioning of anything. And it's a nice evocative phrase, so like the horizon of expectation. I find it useful to think through broken world thinking. And it summarizes for me a whole move that's been going on in the world of technology studies to think about repair studies, to think not just about how things are made and how novelty comes into the world, but also how things are maintained, how they're fixed, how you keep something going and what it takes to do that. So rather than the Silicon Valley style of innovation where you imagine stasis and then disruption, to think about brokenness as being inherent in any technical system and also in the norms of that we live with, that when we enjoy electrical power can always go out, and we tend to forget that, and yet that is inherent, that energy has to be constantly flowing. There's a cost to what we are doing right now, to be reminded of that in a direct kind of way at the outset of asking questions about technology. looks like whenever I, since I'm the host, whenever I admit someone, I also have to click back into the presentation. So these are, hopefully, and it will help illustrate the point I'm trying to make, that we're living in a world where actually we do have to make small adjustments and come up with small workarounds. And when we speak abstractly and think theoretically about systems, we should not forget this. We should not imagine them to be pristine and constantly functioning, but rather to recognize their messiness. And so if we try to think with broken worlds, then I think there's some other questions we might ask, whether some worlds are more broken than others, that is relative to urban norms. They might be perfectly well functioning relative to other possibilities. And yet there are many traditional systems which expect to have lots of available land around you. If you're living a rural life, you can do that. If you're living in a setting where you don't have rights to the land around you and you're in a crowded informal settlement, then you may not be able to practice those traditional ways as easily. How to recognize breakdown within technological imagination itself. So if you have broken worlds, what about broken imaginations? The politics of distribution as well as innovation. So not just a question of when new things come into the world, but how do people get them? Who gets them when and for how long and under what circumstances? And to what extent are urban norms that we live with, the expectations of life that are built into our habits, into our hygiene, into our way, the rhythms of our day. We all expect those of us who live in cities to be able to work at night, usually with bright lights around us. We expect to be able to go out and do things. That's part of what it means to associate, what it means to live in a city, what we associate with urban life. But perhaps within that, there is a seed of something, of a need for repair there as well, not just in the world of the Aishak and informal settlements. And how to fit the Aishak in that sense, and the kinds of questions which I want to put on the table today with modernist expectations, going back to Kozela, going back to the horizon of expectation, what kinds of futures do we imagine? And where do we fit the meantime into that? And if humanitarian design is, in a wonderful phrase of one a colleague who's at Oxford, Tom Scott Smith, tiny improvements wrapped in hyperbole, which sums up a lot of the world of sort of Silicon Valley innovation of getting a slightly better phone or a slightly better iteration of a program. Every now and then there's something that is truly different and better, but a lot of the time it's very, very small adjustments. Humanitarian design is a lot of that too. If that is true, and it's not a very satisfying answer to the meantime, what about critique? And what are we imagining as what would be a better answer to the meantime? Because a great deal of critique, I want to suggest, is embedded in modernist expectations. It's embedded in the notion that everyone should enjoy electricity. It's embedded in the notion that everyone should have a gleaming clinic, and that's what healthcare should look like. And how to adjust for a world with where you have a global landscape of inequality, differential possibilities, ecological stress and potential breakdown and a need for continuing need for repair. And so I'm going to be wrapping up here. So I just show this as an image for those of you who you can see the shared screen. My suggestion is we're living in a time where that field of the future has been compressed for a number of reasons. And here I'm gesturing to some things of why people might have a smaller future that they're imagining when they're devoting a lot of time and energy to building things like little devices, humanitarian design, that the legacy of modernist infrastructure and some of its failures, the perception of ecological limits, the perception of the history of utopian political projects and their perceived failure has led to a foreshortening of what the horizon might be and a lot of uncertainty about what the possibilities might be, as well as large-scale threats that are now seen as being much more imminent than might have been in the past. And thus you have a world of band-aids and hopes for a magic Well, it's in a tension of technological scale between the very modest effects of these devices and the kinds of aspirations, such as adequate housing for everyone, or everyone should enjoy clean drinking water, or everyone should enjoy adequate sanitation. Everyone, no small child should die prematurely. No small child should die of starvation. These kinds of aspirations are met with the technological means seems out of scale to the hopes of what would truly be a brighter future. And so I end with a sort of unhappy, dissatisfying, modest moral of the meantime, as I see it, for technopolitical critique, in that I think the technical political critique is tremendously important and is the thing which I seek to try and do and share with you today, but to recognize that it's not enough to simply point to the shortcomings of small fixes, but rather to also at the same time, I think one needs to recognize that all techniques have politics and all politics have technological expectations built into them. And if you are fighting for social justice, you then also have to be thinking about the material possibilities of delivering that, how it will work or how it will not work, and what the costs might be to achieve that dream. And so I'll end here with this image. This is from the iShack as part of their promotional brochures, and I like it because it reminds me of socialist realism and art, of sort of the triumphant view. And yet, at the end of the day, this is for the iShack. I mean, that's what we're left with. It's not a new society, which would be a hoped for utopian field of possibility. And that's why I began and end with this question of how modest a utopia can be. So I will stop sharing here so we can have a discussion. And thank you for listening to me. And I'm going to stop being the host also at this point. And I apologize because I forgot to press the record button, which I was supposed to do. But hopefully someone else recorded it for you. Since my workaround, it's a good example of technological failure on my end in this particular case.
Thanks very much, Peter.